I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, what if an unabashedly left-wing politician, like, say, a Bernie Sanders in the United States, or a Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom, was elected to the highest office in a Western country? Many leftists believe that it would lead to a fundamental and necessary change. Chris Nynam, a founding member of Britain's Stop the War Coalition and author of How the Establishment Lost Control, however, argues that it would not be smooth sailing in his newest book, The British State: A Warning. In this provocative new title, soon to be released by Zero Books, Nynam attempts to persuade the reader that the British state has historically worked in the interests of the status quo and would put up a fight in the event of a left-wing leader like the Labour Party's Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister. Moreover, Nynam argues against what he sees as the mythology of the British state, which is more often than not portrayed as slowly paving the way for progress and democracy through gradualism or incrementalism. Nynam says this couldn't be farther from the truth, and details the various repressive policies and actions taken by the British state against dissidents throughout its history. In lieu of the chaos that is Brexit, there remains a possibility of Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister. With that in mind, perhaps it would be worthwhile for the left to consider Nynam's thesis, but I'll let Chris make the case for that himself. And now, without further ado, my conversation with Chris Nynam, author of The British State: A Warning. Welcome to Parallax Views, Chris Nynam, author of the new Zero Books title, The British State, A Warning. And before that, you also wrote How the Establishment Lost Control, two books I would highly recommend for listeners of Parallax Views.
It's great to be here. Thanks very much.
Well, Chris, I want to get into this new book, The British State, A Warning. But first I want to ask you, because my listeners are very interested in the topic, what in the world is going on with Brexit?
Well, how long you got? I mean, there's chaos, basically, as you probably can tell. There's political and constitutional chaos in Britain at the moment. And it's very hard to predict how it's going to turn out. I mean, I think the two most likely outcomes at the moment are, one is that we crash out, that there's no deal, there's just a kind of unregulated end of the relationship, which would be fairly chaotic, probably not a disaster, but not good. Or there might be an extension, there might be an agreement to sort of keep talking, which I think is probably on balance the more likely outcome. But that's just a starting point, really.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think listeners who are interested in understanding Brexit should read How the Establishment Lost Control. You sort of get into how something like Brexit ended up happening, how there's so much rage against the establishment. In a way, though, I think that the British state provides more context. In a way, it's almost like a prequel. It sort of gives you the background to how this all happened. Maybe you could sort of describe what you mean by the title of that book, The British State, A Warning.
Well, I mean, what I'm looking at is the kind of unelected, mainly the sort of unelected parts of the British state. Because there's a myth, there's a big myth in Britain that, you know, Britain's the home of gradualism and the mother of all parliaments and the cradle of democracy and all these things. In reality, and the British state has ruled in quite a brutal way historically. Obviously, there's the British Empire, but even internally, there's a long history of the police and the courts and the army actually being used against protesters and against social movements, and, you know, even against the democracy movement, which was absolutely savagely repressed and attacked right throughout the 19th century. And actually, Britain got the vote very late. It wasn't until 1928 we got universal suffrage. So there's all that about the British state. And then there's also, whenever a Labour government has been elected, and certainly any Labour governments that have tried to change things in any sort of serious way, they've been sort of subverted, and there's all sorts of obstacles that's been put up to stop their policies being enacted. There's been investment strikes. So really the book's about how the kind of less talked about elements of the state are brought into play to defend the status quo. And, you know, I think one of the things that's happening in Britain at the moment is people are getting fed up with the lack of democracy, that people are getting very angry at the way that the political elites are so close to big business and so close to corporate power. And that is one of the reasons why we are in this situation, why we have this Brexit vote in the first place.
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, there's a sort of provocative nature to this book. I think one of the blurbs for it, Brian Eno referred to it as a provocative sort of thesis for a lot of people. And I think it would apply here in the United States as well. I mean, a book that sort of interrogates the British state, or just interrogates the state in general, if we can apply it to United States audiences from a left-wing perspective, I think that's become very provocative for a lot of people that consider themselves to be of the left tradition.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think one of the reasons I wrote it is because there's a big, obviously we have Jeremy Corbyn as head of the Labour Party at the moment. He's the most left-wing leader the Labour Party's ever had. You know, it's exciting. I'm excited. This could be a big moment if he does get elected. But I think there's a lot of confidence amongst in the left that, you know, when he gets elected, it's all going to roll out. You know, we're going to get more money. We're going to get more schools. We're going to get taxes on the rich. We're going to get corporation taxes going to rise. We're going to get controls on capital movement. We're going to have a different foreign policy. All this stuff is just going to happen. And my view is that actually there's been all sorts of attempts to sabotage Jeremy Corbyn and his project, even now, ever since he became leader of the Labour Party in 2015. I think those attempts will be like a tea party compared to what happens if he does get elected and his radical program is still intact. So, I mean, that's my thesis, really, that we really need to be prepared for a rough ride.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I know a lot of people in the United States that think, you know, if we can just get a Bernie presidency, you know, things would change immediately. But, you know, I want to reference a novel here, and I think you mention it in the book, a novel called A Very British Coup, which sort of it's a novel about a labor leader that gets into power, and he's very left wing. But the establishment doesn't go down without a fight. And I think that a lot of people on the left in both the US and Britain forget that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's like there's a failure to look at history, you know, because in Britain, the last radical Labour government was in the 70s. And it came in on really quite a kind of serious sort of redistributive program. And, you know, it talked about actually increasing some level of employee control over the economy and so on and so forth. But I mean, you know, there was every aspect of the establishment was mobilized in one form or another to make it impossible for it to enact that program, really. And after just 2 years, it had dropped every single one of its radical proposals. And funnily enough, that government presided over the biggest fall in working class living standards since the 1930s. And so, you know, really, we need to know about this stuff if we're going to be prepared for what happens in the future. You know, it's just crazy for people not to go in with our eyes wide open.
Well, you know, I want to get into the Wilson government because I find it a very interesting time in British history. But maybe we can back up a little bit. And look at the introduction of your book. I like the title, The Myth of Gradualism. Maybe we could discuss sort of what gradualism is, what we mean by that, and how the ideas about the British state and, you know, its furtherance of democracy within the, you know, the mainstream idea of it are sort of at odds with the reality, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, if you look at Parliament, I don't know how many of your watchers or listeners have ever seen pictures of the British Parliament, but it's built in this kind of retro Gothic style. It looks like a medieval. It was built in the 19th century, but it looks like a medieval building, kind of. And I think what they were trying to do, it's like kind of propaganda architecture. And it's trying to suggest this unbroken history of kind of mediation and compromise and British liberty is how they talk about it, that somehow there's been an evolution of an organic unfolding of the kind of democratic spirit in British society, you know, that culminated in the 1928 enactment of universal suffrage, and that basically, you know, that's always been the way that the state has been very small, very neutral, and just be enabling the development of this kind of these freedoms, really. Now, I mean, it's quite extraordinary that that myth has such purchase, because it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, the level of sort of hyper-violence that has been perpetrated by the British state around the world is probably unmatched in human history, or perhaps that's a slight exaggeration, but certainly Britain ran the biggest empire there's ever been in the world, and it ran it very, very brutally. And that was one of the reasons, funnily enough, that's one of the reasons why it was able to sort of pitch itself as so humane at home. But it's also true that people who were trying to win democracy in Britain, struggle for democracy from way back, but certainly throughout the 19th century, were treated with the utmost ruthlessness by the British state. Lots were deported, some were killed, loads were imprisoned. You know, wave after wave of democratic campaigning was defeated by a ruling class that was absolutely committed to making sure working people didn't have the vote. You know, the extreme opposite of what the myth is. So it's actually an interesting puzzle, an interesting question as to how this myth has been able to sustain itself. But it definitely is a myth, trust me.
Well, one of the characters that comes up very early in the book, and I wanted to talk a little bit about him because he's been a figure that comes up in a lot of my interviews for some reason, is Edmund Burke and the Whig Party. How does Edmund Burke play into the conceptualization of the state and its purpose?
Well, Edmund Burke wrote his considerations on the French Revolution in the 1790s, and he was trying to create a different narrative. You know, the French Revolution actually panicked the British state, and there was all sorts of kind of radicalization going on amongst the artisans and workers and, you know, early working class in Britain at the time. And one of the things they did was to brutally crush those movements, but they also needed to establish some sort of kind of alternative narrative to that of the French, which was, you know, a state run, a kind of, you know, statist kind of move towards liberty, equality and fraternity. And the Edmund Burke's idea was this sort of organic one. It was this idea that there's something about the way property works in Britain. There's something about the way the market works in Britain. There's something about the British spirit that actually enables the organic unrolling of freedoms. And he counterposes those freedoms to the state. So, you know, as far as he's concerned, the state can only bring, you know, a challenge to the individuality that characterizes British, the British politics and British society, in his view. So it's a very anti-statist view, and it's one of the founding documents of British conservatism. And British conservatism was always, in theory and in words, being very hostile to the state. And you know, it pitches British society as the society of private property, the individual, and a gradual evolution of freedoms.
Well, what are some of, to you, the main examples of the sort of the word brutality comes up a lot in the early chapters of the book. What are the main examples of brutality imposed by the British state that you think are worth reevaluating to better understand the problem of the state?
Well, I mean, leaving aside imperialism for the moment, which is like a big thing to take out of the equation, but I'm just focusing a little bit on what happened in Britain itself, because it's in a way less talked about. The first half of the 19th century, there was all sorts of massive movements, including calling for democracy, including in 1832 a virtual insurgency where whole cities were taken over by working people for days on end, where prisons were opened, where castles and mansion houses were burnt down, all calling for the vote. And that movement did start the process of reform, but tiny extension of the vote. But it was also met with massive force, and that set the pattern, really. I mean, actually, the pattern had been set previously. Famously, in 1819, there was the Peterloo Massacre, where 15 or 16 or possibly 18 people were killed on a pro-democracy demonstration. The Chartists, which was the biggest working class movement in the world at the time, calling again for universal suffrage, or at least for male suffrage, they were partly crushed by a massive show of military force in 1848. So, you know, you're really the period in which the British state kind of emerged, the modern British state emerged, was a period of massive levels of brutality against ordinary people, many of whom were shipped off to, the leaders were shipped off to Australia, or they were imprisoned, or left to die in prisons very often. And so by about 1850, the democratic movement was badly defeated by this level of violence.
Well, when does that sort of pivot where it sort of becomes, you know, there's a different method to sort of quelling the democratic spirit through this British state. When does the tactic change over from brutality to a more sort of a soft brutality or a sort of I think you understand what I'm getting at. Do I need to clarify a little bit more?
No. I think you're right. I mean, I think about the middle of the century, you know, that experience was so the experience of kind of trying to decapitate the movements literally with physical force, I think was, you know, quite problematic even from the elite's point of view, because the danger always was that level of violence would lead to just more anger and the spread of the movements. And also it's quite difficult to sustain the process of exploitation if there's a constant level of resistance and struggle going on. So I think they did make a move in the middle of the century towards a bit more of an attempt to accommodate, to create some institutions that were a bit more inclusive, to give a little in terms of reforms and stuff. And even towards the end of the 19th century, obviously they started to very reluctantly, it has to be said, but in the face of continuing pressure, they did widen the franchise. But I mean, the important thing is that most of the institutions of the British state actually predate democracy. You know, the army, the police, the civil service, the judiciary, lots of elements of the kind of constitutional way the society works. These things were set up, you know, before, way, way before 1928. So what you have is, by the time, democracy has been kind of reluctantly conceded, you have a whole series of kind of bulwarks and defences against that kind of hem Parliament in and limit the ability of what has been of the democratic gains to actually make much influence over society. And particularly, and this is true in different ways and to different degrees across democratic societies, but more than anything, there's a very conscious attempt to separate off politics and economics. We'll give you political democracy, but you're not allowed to step into the state, the democratic state is not allowed to step anywhere near private property, what goes on in the factory, what goes on in the workplace, the distribution of wealth. All these things are kind of out of bounds for democracy. So you have, when it finally arrives, you have a kind of, you know, a democracy that's been massively restricted and massively weakened by a kind of process that took place across the second half of the 19th century in particular.
Well, I was going to say, in reference to that, I like how you start the book with a quote from a British comedy series called Yes, Minister. And I think in a lot of ways it sums that hemming in of Parliament up. You know, the quote is, question, I don't think he's got much clout in Whitehall, has he? Answer, none at all, he's just a minister. And, you know, I laughed out loud because I actually used to watch that show, you know, because I like a lot of British TV, but it sort of sums up that sort of hemming in of Parliament.
No, absolutely, absolutely. You know, the civil service is a permanent civil service. So, you know, people, it may not be quite so true now, partly because the civil service is almost been handed over to the corporations. But traditionally, the civil service is a kind of career job where, you know, people work all their life in particular departments. And so they are permanently in control of administering, whether it's the Foreign Office, the Ministry of Defence, the Home Office or the financial side. You know, these people are the people who are experts. They know it inside out. They do the actual administering, and the politicians just come and go, you know. And the truth is that these institutions influence the politicians far more than the politicians influence them. And that's been the history. So it was it's a clever thing to have this very, very big permanent civil service, which is handpicked from the elites, that really, you know, I mean, there's lots of other elements to it, but they really do set the agenda. They control the limits of the possible. There's a brilliant quote from Tony Benn, who was a left-wing minister in the 1970s, where he says that he was elected as industry minister. And he says that his permanent secretary, the civil servant who was assigned to him, basically treated him like he was a particularly dangerous psychiatric patient. And, you know, just never really accepted this man, this radical, could possibly be in a ministerial position, and certainly didn't do anything that he asked him to do.
Well, it's very interesting because I see a lot of parallels here in the United States. I mean, I think we have an entrenched sort of a band of technocrats. I hesitate to use the word deep state because that's become associated with, you know, right-wing conspiracy theories and whatnot. But, you know, there sort of is an entrenched state apparatus that has a lot more say a lot of times here in the U.S. than the politicians do.
No, absolutely. It's true. I think it's true in every capitalist society to a greater degree or a lesser degree. But the thing about the deep state is that, in a way, talk about the deep state, in a certain sense, kind of underestimates the influence and power and importance of the state as a whole. I mean, there is a deep state, there's secret services and you know, people associated with them. But don't tell me that the rest of the state doesn't know they exist. I mean, the security services are kept secret from us, but, you know, many people in the rest of the state institutions know they're there. And anyway, all of the state in different ways plays a role, not just the deep state. The deep state will be wheeled out at times of, you know, real serious crisis, when other methods are failing. But the state as a whole, in different and complex ways, is there precisely to protect and to maintain the status quo. So when people talk about the deep state as if that's the problem, in a way they're being kind of naive about the rest of the state institutions, the judges, you know, the top civil servants, the people in the army, the people who run the police force. I mean, these people are all committed to defending private property, defending the way the way society works in its current setup. That's the truth.
Do you think a lot of the problem is that the state itself is just not sort of democratically run?
That's exactly the problem. I mean, you've got this situation where, you know, one element of the state, parliament, is elected democratically. I mean, with many kind of part of it is elected democratically anyway, and there's many problems even with that process. But, you know, the actual kind of the bits that do the work, the bits that enact the policy and actually administer it, there's no democracy in them whatsoever. Not only is there no democracy, but they are specifically, their leaders and managers are specifically recruited from the elite layers in society. I mean, Oxford University and Cambridge University and the public school system in Britain, which is actually the private school system in Britain, typically kind of weird way of talking about things. But that those institutions are largely, their purpose is to kind of select people who are going to be loyal, who see themselves as an elite, who are going to be pro-regime, pro-status quo, to work in these kind of professions, you know, in the legal profession, in the media, in the civil service, and so on and so forth. So there's an actual process of recruiting these people who will defend the system. So, yeah, I think democracy is the question. And, you know, what we need to have is a much more thoroughgoing democracy where, you know, the split between the executive and the legislature, where, you know, you get the people who put the laws through elected and the rest of them aren't, that needs to be overcome. We need a situation where the whole lot of them are elected, because the ones that actually do the business are the ones with the most power, the ones that actually, you know, manage society are unelected at the moment, and that's completely unacceptable. And you know, that needs to be dealt with. And I think one of the big tasks of the left at the moment is to imagine and start to struggle for much, much more thoroughgoing versions of democracy. Because actually what's happened is we've got the opposite going on at the moment, which is that corporate power is extending its control not only over the unelected areas of the state, but over the elected areas as well. So we've got, you know, a parliament that has more and more lobbied by, blackmailed and bribed by big business, more and more in the pockets of the big banks and the big corporations than it's ever been. So it's not just a question of pushing that back, but it's also a question of thinking, okay, how are we going to get a much more democratic way of running this society? And I just think that one of the worries is that, you know, the left seems to think, or some of the left seems to think, that that's going to happen simply by electing a new government and a new party into power. And I don't think this can be done from the top down. I mean, obviously some efforts can be made, but this process of democratization has really got to come from the grassroots. It's got to come from the bottom up.
Well, you know, I think this sort of gets into one of the main points of the book. Is you have a fair bit of criticism of the Labour Party historically, and you know, I think it's up for criticism because it wasn't able to prevent the rise of things like Thatcherism and neoliberalism. What do you think is the role of the Labour Party in you know, this British state and this crisis we're facing now?
Well, I think, I mean, funnily enough, one of the reasons why there is this kind of lingering belief in the sort of gradualism of British history is that the main institutions of the left in Britain have bought into it historically. I mean, more so really than most countries, probably not more so than America, but certainly more so than a lot of European countries. There is, from the beginning, the Labour Party was wedded to this idea that, you know, you could change things through the institutions, that the British ruling class would be up for an accommodation, for compromise, for a gradual shift in power away from the elites towards ordinary people. And, you know, that belief, which is embodied in the Labour Party, has been very, very influential on the left in Britain and has kind of, you know, coloured the way people think about social change massively. And, you know, this is a big problem. I think in a way that process is now in a bit it coming to a kind of crisis, because, you know, what Corbyn represents and the leadership of the new leadership of the Labour Party, it represents a kind of insurgency by the left. And actually by, you know, Jeremy's very much associated with the social movements, with the anti-war movement, anti-austerity movement, Palestine movements and so forth. He comes very much, I mean, he's always been in the Labour Party and he's a long-term MP, but he's been very much involved in the campaigns. And so I think what you're seeing at the moment is, for the first time ever, the leadership is kind of taken over by people who at least have one eye on street politics, one eye on extra-parliamentary politics. And that's a big change. And, you know, that's very, very important. But, you know, we need to draw the right conclusion from that, because it seems to me that, you know, we must understand that Corbynism comes to a certain extent from the street. But we must also understand that if he gets elected, the only way that the programme can be pushed through is if the people, you know, as if there still are movements in the street who are prepared to campaign for him, to help push back the right, to take on some of the struggles for new policies and so on and so forth. It seems to me that, and that's the problem of the 70s and the Wilson government. When Tony Benn, for example, was sacked from his frontline job because he was too left wing at the behest of the city, there were no protests in the street. You know, when the Labour Party were forced by the IMF and the Bank of England to start to impose austerity and wage cuts in 1976, there were no protests in the street. And I think that's something that we really need to make sure isn't repeated. We need to have a situation where we don't just think parliament politics is what happens in parliament. We have to understand that any radical political project can only be successful if it's accompanied by a much, much wider social mobilization.
Would it be okay if we talked a little bit about the Wilson government? I think it's a very interesting moment in British history. You mentioned Tony Benn. Tony Benn and Wilson, I guess a lot of people would call that old Labour as opposed to new Labour. And there's a lot of, how do I put this? There's a lot of conspiracy theories around, repression or attacks on the Wilson government. What do you make of those sort of ideas on the left?
Well, I think it's complicated. I mean, there definitely were conspiracies to organise coups. I mean, it's an established fact. There was quite high ranking people in the British establishment who regarded the whole thing as, as being far too radical, and that they needed to get organized. There was an economic crisis at the time as well. And there's a number of attempts, which often had the support of at least sections of the security services. So there was that going on. There was also undeniably security service demonization and dirty tricks against Wilson, and particularly against Tony Benn. Wilson was much more right wing and mainstream than Tony Benn, who was moving to the left. And he was really regarded as being completely unacceptable by the British establishment. And he was hounded really by the media and by the Secret Service and the Civil Service, and before and until he was eventually, as I say, he was removed from his cabinet position, his frontline cabinet position. But here's the thing. One of the ways that this plays out, and is playing out now in Labour, and it played out then in the government, was that the right wing of Labour, the which tends to be the majority in the parliamentary party anyway, are part of that operation against the left. And so if you read some of the quotes that I have from Tony Benn's diaries, or better still, read Tony Benn's diaries themselves, he's always talking about the way that other cabinet ministers were gagging him as, at the same time as he was being hounded by the security services. He actually asked the Home Secretary, Merlin Rees, whether his phone was being tapped, because he started to believe that it was, for various reasons. And Merlin Rees said, "I couldn't tell you. I'm not in the position to be able to tell you." This is a cabinet minister speaking to a cabinet minister. So you know, the operation that will take place under a Corbyn government will be various parts of the establishment putting pressure in various different ways, and the corporate world putting pressure. But one of the main channels for that will be the actual right wing of Labour, which is kind of, will be used to try and isolate, marginalise and push back against the left. And I think that's one of the most important lessons of the 1970s.
Well, I want to move towards the 1980s and the rise of Thatcher and what has been called neoliberalism. I don't know, maybe we could parse this out a bit, because I feel like neoliberalism as a term is thrown out around a lot, but it's usually not defined for people that may not be familiar with the terminology. Maybe we could get into what neoliberalism is and how it sort of arose in Britain, especially in the Thatcher years.
Well, I think the evolution of neoliberalism was kind of a gradual and, kind of partly pragmatic and accidental process. It wasn't something that was, popped up as a fully formed theory, although there were intellectuals who were pursuing different versions of it at different times. But basically what it's about is increasing corporate power in society, pushing the state out of intervention into the free market, and crucially opening up the state itself and various elements of the welfare state, but not just the welfare state, to big capital, so that profits can be made out of things that were previously state run. And obviously, we've seen those things happen across the board. One important point that I make in the book, though, which is needs to be held on to, despite the rhetoric, this is not about shrinking the state. It's about retooling the state, because the state spending in Britain didn't ever go down under Thatcher and hasn't really gone down since. It's just the state does different things, whereas previously it had in Britain some responsibility for, you know, making people's lives better and ensuring that working people didn't starve and were housed and were looked after properly. Those things have been largely or partly eroded. It plays a very big role now in enabling finance capital to move around society and to move into all sorts of different sectors of society. It supports corporate power in a way. It's a very corporate state now, just not just in terms of who runs it, but in terms of what its functions are. So that's a rough outline of the neoliberal project. And I think the important thing here for me is this, that people say we can learn a lot from the sort of neoliberal takeover of society in the late 70s and early 80s for our project in the, hopefully, if Corbyn does get elected, for a left-wing project. Now, I'm not saying that's completely untrue, but I think there's a false assumption built into that argument, which is this, that neoliberalism wasn't some sort of revolution. It wasn't some sort of overturning of class power. It wasn't a fundamental transformation of society. It was just a different way of to organize profits. I mean, it was a more effective way, and it was a more brutal way in some ways. But it was essentially a kind of a change in strategy for the same class of people. What we're talking about, the kind of transformation we as socialists are looking at or looking for, is that, you know, we want people whose lives, our lives, have been shattered over the last 40 years. We want the majority in society, working people in society, to have more power and ultimately to actually be able to run things. And that's a much more, that's a way, way more radical change than anything that happened between the late 60s and the early 1980s. So, you know, the idea that, OK, Thatcher went in and cleared out a few civil servants and brought in a few experts. And that was OK then, because essentially they were all on the same side. They had disagreements, tactical disagreements. They were all on the same side broadly. What if we tried to just move in and get rid of a few top civil servants and bring in our own people? There'd be all hell to pay, because these would be, we'd be bringing in people who wanted a fundamental reversal of the kind of power that power relationships within society. And that won't be acceptable to the elites. So in a way, that's when I say the British state a warning, that is the warning that I'm trying to bring to people.
Well, it's interesting, too, in terms of Thatcher. I think here in the U.S., you know, people know of Margaret Thatcher now because there was a movie a few years back called The Iron Lady with Meryl Streep. But I don't think in Britain she's necessarily extremely well-liked, even during her time in office. Maybe you could clear that up for my listeners in the U.S. that may have a more positive view of her for some odd reason.
Yeah, I mean, Thatcher was the most hated prime minister that I think Britain had had up to that time. I mean, maybe we've had one or two who've got even more of a problem, of a public relations problem since then. But yeah, it's an important point to hold on to. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls, there was never a time when the majority of the working people in Britain supported Thatcher. There was never a time when the majority of working people kind of bought into the free market, bought into privatization, bought into the kind of ideas and policies that she supported. The problem is people got defeated. And this is the other side of Thatcherism. When it came to changes in the state and the civil service, you know, they were made without a great deal of resistance. The resistance that she did come up against was from working people on a massive scale, huge strikes, some of the biggest strikes in British history. And she dealt with them again with the utmost brutality, involving the army and the police and, you know, very, very serious levels of physical violence. And it was actually the defeat of the trade unions. And the similar thing happened under Reagan in the US in the 1980s, although probably the strikes were less confrontational. But, you know, it was the defeat of those big strikes, the printers, the dockers, the health workers, and crucially the miners in the early to mid 80s. It was that that allowed her to continue. It was that it was those defeats that created the sort of social demoralization that allowed her to carry on and inflict so much damage on British society.
It's always fascinated me that quote she had where she says, you know, there is no alternative. In other words, no alternative to free market capitalism. And it seems like that's become an orthodoxy now. I think it's slowly being questioned in the 21st century. But what do you think of the legacy of that idea of, you know, I guess it's been called TINA. Like I said, there is no alternative. And its ability to just capture, you know, the sort of mainstream view of things.
Yeah, I think it's very it's obviously a very influential. I mean, she had quite a way with words, Margaret Thatcher, it has to be said. But the important thing is this: she wouldn't have been able to get away with that idea, and actually she wouldn't have been able to get away with decimating the British working class and the terrible things that she did to the fabric of society in Britain if it hadn't been for the fact that the Labour Party in those first 5 or 6 years of the 1980s really bought into that idea that there is no alternative. That idea was accepted by the Labour Party. And it was precisely that idea that Tony Blair embodied. He took over the leadership of the Labour Party in 1994. And then obviously he became Prime Minister in 1997. And that was the moment when Labour completely bought into the free market. And, you know, the idea that there was any kind of option of democratically running society or running society for the benefit of the majority, or any kind of, you know, the idea that we could consciously as human beings in a democratic way try and shape the institutions of society. Forget it. It's all over. It's all about the free market. It's all about this disembodied, unequal, and incredibly destructive free market framework. And it was the fact that Labour and the bulk of what passed for the left in Britain bought into that and accepted that, that allowed the right to get away with it. And I think that's, you know, again, that's another very, very important thing we have to hold on to.
Well, doesn't something similar also happen when you get the switch from Harold Wilson to, and I may be mispronouncing the name, James Callaghan or Callaghan?
That's right, Callaghan, yeah. Yeah, that's the beginning of the process. That is the beginning of the process. You can date it very exactly to a period in 1975 when, then when Labour begins to accept, when Callaghan's the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he actually begins to introduce austerity policies in the face of an economic crisis. And then in 1976, when he's leader of the Labour, he becomes the leader of the Labour Party. He then makes a famous speech at the Labour Party conference where he says, you know, we can't carry on like this. We can't carry on spending money on welfare. We can't carry on trying to create a more equal society. It's just not an option anymore. The cold winds of economic crisis and marketization around the world are creating an environment in which this is no longer possible. And that's the moment when the rot really starts to set in Labour. But it takes another 20 years for it to finally be a kind of dominate in an open way, or sort of open way, where Tony Blair says, you know, that he has a lot of admiration for Thatcher, and where Thatcher actually says, when asked what is the most important element of her legacy, her answer is Tony Blair. And so you see this kind of, you know, the influence of free market ideas right across the political spectrum. And that was a very, very important part of the whole story about how neoliberalism managed to embed itself. Often the story is told in the other way around. Often the story is told that, you know, ordinary people accepted it and Labour had to go along with that. Not true. I mean, again, if you look at the opinion polls, time after time, you find most ordinary working class people really didn't like it. And people accepted the rightward shift in Labour simply because they kind of lost hope in alternatives, really, and largely because of the big industrial defeats the workers had suffered, which just knocked the stuffing out of them in the first half of the 1980s.
Maybe you could just fill my listeners in on what some of those defeats were more specifically or in more detail.
Well, there was actually a plan that was organised by the Tories in the late 70s before Thatcher got into power, where they drew up a kind of strategy to take on the trade unions. And they talked about salami tactics, taking each union on one by one and trying to be very careful not to to create a kind of big working class opposition, you know, that would lead to solidarity and so on. And they picked off some of the weaker unions first and then gradually built up to a confrontation with the biggest and most important union in British society at the time, which was the miners' union, which had, I think it had about getting on for 200,000 members and, you know, a huge amount of power. And they organised very, very carefully to take on the miners. And they made sure they had huge stockpiles of coal. They made sure that they had a very mobile kind of paramilitary police operation. And they forced the union eventually into taking a strike action in 1984. And they virtually sealed off the mining areas, didn't allow pickets to come in and out. When there were mass pickets, they beat them mercilessly. They picked off the weaker unions first, and then they actually had a couple of trial runs against some more powerful unions, particularly the printers union, who they took on. A particular employer took on a closed shop agreement in Warrington in, I think it was 1983, where the police tried out their new strategy of attacking pickets, and it was successful. And they then rolled out a kind of full spectrum state operation against the miners, who were the biggest union and the most powerful union anyway in British society at the time. It's like 200,000 members with a whole lot of power. And they used the police, they used the army, they manipulated the press, they had all sorts of they demonised the union leaders. The secret services did security, sort of dirty trick operations against them. They recruited a whole layer of sort of scab lorry drivers. There was a massive operation to break the miners in 1984-85. It was a heroic strike. It lasted, I think, 13 months, longest strike in British history of any size. And it got defeated, and that was a huge blow. I mean, it had the support of workers across the country, but disastrously, no other trade union took actual strike action in support of the miners, and they were left to hang on their own, really, which was a catastrophe. And we've been paying for that defeat for many, many years since.
Well, you know, before we begin to wrap up, I wanted to go back to Tony Blair. I've always found it interesting that, you know, since leaving the political realm, he gets into the private sector. I think it's very interesting because we have a lot of people end up in the public sector through the private sector, and then people that leave the public sector go into the private sector. It's very incestuous, and it's very anti-meritocratic, not... I mean, I don't really believe in the concept of meritocracy anyways. I don't think that's something that has ever really existed in reality. But I think it's become even more apparent now, especially in that example of Tony Blair. I mean, he goes straight into the private sector.
No, that's absolutely right. We call it the revolving door. It's like, you know, and it's extraordinary the number of politicians and senior civil servants who end up on the boards of merchant banks and big corporations. I mean, this happens all the time. And it's actually a good illustration of the fact that, you know, the state isn't in any serious sense independent. They talk about independence, that the civil service is independent and neutral. I mean, the only thing that civil service is independent of is the politicians. It's independent of democratic control, but it's absolutely embedded in the kind of elite social structure of the British ruling class. And I mean, more so than ever, really, because now we've got a situation where literally sections of state administration is kind of is outsourced to big business. I mean, and I'm not just talking about, you know, parts of the health service or parts of the welfare state. I mean, even policy making happens in the, you know, it's policy discussions in the civil service takes place now in association with and in close cooperation with big business. And whenever there's a discussion about changing and the necessity to change a regulation or something, private business is brought into the civil service discussion. That's what happens. So there's a kind of merging and synthesis of the state and big business, which is unprecedented even in Britain, to be honest.
I was going to say, I think the term is, and I may be mispronouncing this as well, quango, or quasi-autonomous non-governmental organization.
Yeah, that's one element of it. The quangos that are completely undemocratic, that not just undemocratic, but they're not transparent. I mean, there's no record of them. No one really knows. No one in outside of the immediate circles that they're operating is know who's on them, what role they're playing. They're not. Their discussions are not recorded for the public. You know, this is the kind of way that the British society is administered now. And of course, it's true in lots of other societies. But I think Britain was one of the capitalist societies in the West that pioneered this kind of way of running society. And of course, the problem with it is, it means that, you know, if we get a left wing government, the vested interests that are in control of the administering of society are going to be very, very difficult to dislodge. And they're no way are these people going to go quietly. You know, they're absolutely committed to the free market. They're absolutely committed to sort of financialization and to the central role of banking in British society. And the idea that a government can just come in and give them a few orders and they'll meekly carry them out is a fantasy. And it's a fantasy we've got to move beyond fairly quickly, and we've got to think seriously about how we're going to deal with this, because it's a very, very big problem.
Well, you mentioned earlier the issue of imperialism, and I feel like I didn't ask about that enough, but I think we can tie it in here at the end. What is the role of war and empire within the British state and sort of the trajectory we are at right now with regards to politics?
Well, I mean, this is a very important question, because, you know, the truth is that despite the fact that Britain is no longer a major imperial power, the British ruling class are still clinging on to what they see as global Britain, the idea that Britain should have a disproportionately international role, that we should, you know, be in the UN Security Council, that we should play a strong role in the IMF and all these things. And that is predicated on having a relatively big army, on being able to intervene in different places around the world to prop up our reputation and our power, and to give to back up our corporations as they compete for contracts and markets around the world. And we're still clinging on to that. We can't do it on our own anymore. So what we do is, in Britain, we think, oh, I know, let's be the most loyal poodle to the biggest imperialist power, which is the US. And that's really what the so-called special relationship. I don't suppose you have that term in America, but the British establishment like to flatter themselves that they have a special deal with the US president, which is largely a fiction. But the extent to which it is special is that we are especially subservient. We are especially supportive and loyal to US foreign policy, however crazy it may be. And this is, you know, still a very, very important part of the what laughingly passes for a kind of vision of Britain's future in our establishment. And it's important because there are some people on the left in Britain, even around the whole kind of Labour left at the moment, who think, let's not worry about the foreign policy stuff. Those arguments are too difficult and too complicated, and, you know, we can't really get into them. Let's just be anti-austerity, drop the NATO talk, drop talk of opposition to NATO, drop talk of supporting the Palestinians. They're controversial things, and we'll come back to them maybe sometime in the future. I think that's very, very wrong. I don't think you can have, given Britain's imperial past and the ruling class's continued belief in a sort of some kind of second-rate neocolonial future, I don't think you can have a progressive project that doesn't challenge the foreign wars, that doesn't challenge the massive arms spending, that doesn't challenge Britain's support for Israel. I think really the two things have to go hand in hand. And that's the great thing about, I mean, a lot, he's been forced to make a lot of retreats already, but Jeremy Corbyn is someone who is against spending all this money on weapons of mass destruction. He was against the Iraq war. He's against bombing Syria. He was against the attack on Libya. He would be against foreign intervention. So in that sense, you know, if we could get him in and keep in the streets, we do have the possibility of this kind of this radical opening for a really fundamentally different vision of the kind of future for Britain, not just at home, but Britain's role in the world. And that's very, very exciting. It's something worth fighting for. We've just got to understand it's going to be one hell of a fight.
Well, you know, on that note, I think it's interesting because it's similar in the U.S. There's a lot of people in the U.S. on the left that have shied away from talking about foreign policy, which I find very bizarre for, you know, multiple reasons. But two of the big ones are, you know, people are worried about climate change, and rightfully so, but you can't really address climate change without addressing militarism's role in climate change. And not only that, but the mess we see ourselves in now with things like a resurgent right-wing nationalism here in the U.S. with Trump, in Britain we have Brexit, you know, these things I think are due in part due to the failures of people like Tony Blair and George Bush in regards to the Iraq war. I mean, people do not have trust in the elites anymore because they were lied into a war or at the very least misled. And it just boggles my mind that people don't want to connect these dots.
Absolutely. I think you're 100% right, because I mean, unless you do challenge militarism and challenge kind of, you know, aggressive nationalism, and do it systematically and thoughtfully and, you know, effectively, you know, you're not going to be able to challenge the kind of ideology of the establishment and of the ruling class in any sort of way. And they can always fall back on that. I mean, that's one of the things. But there is also the whole question of, you know, the levels of waste that are created. I think this is a very, very important point. I think that, that we have to challenge militarism. We have to challenge kind of the xenophobia at the heart of the foreign interventions, because otherwise it will come back to bite us. That's the truth. And as you say, there's all the question of the huge waste, the huge proportion of resources in American and British society that are spent on these weapons and on the military that could be would be so valuable if they were used to deal with some of the social problems that exist. And I think, you know, we have to challenge it on that basis as well. So I think for all those reasons, I think, you know, the idea that you can have a serious progressive movement, progressive politics that doesn't deal with the issues around foreign intervention, militarism and war, it's just a fantasy, and it's one that we need to challenge. And the other thing about it, as you say, is that actually the series of wars that both the US and Britain have been involved in over the last 19 years have been one of the factors that have led to the sort of contempt for the political elites and so forth. And actually being anti-war is quite a popular thing. I mean, that's the irony of it all. During the last election in 2017, there was a terrible terrorist attack in Manchester in the middle of the election. And Jeremy Corbyn made the very brave decision to do a press conference the next day where he said, you know, the reason why terrorism is spreading around the world, the main reason why it's happening is because of the disastrous Western foreign policies that have happened over the last 10 or 15 years. Now, that really struck a chord with people. You know, far from being seen as too radical, that was something that actually confirmed in people's minds that Jeremy Corbyn was someone who would speak truth to power, who would actually break the mold of politics that has dominated over the last couple of decades. And he, you know, 75% of the population agreed with that statement in the polls that were done in the next few days. So it's not unpopular to be, I mean, surprise, surprise, it's not unpopular to be against spending billions and billions of dollars on massacring people and sending working class people out to die. It's actually a vote winner if only people realized it.
Well, you know, I always like to say that I like to end on a positive note. It's a bit hard to do that in these trying times. But I guess in closing, I wanted to get your thoughts on maybe how British state a warning could be useful to non-British audiences, and also what hopes you see for the left going forward.
Well, I mean, you know, I do encourage people to buy it for all sorts of reasons, but I think, you know, hopefully it provides a little bit of an explanation as to how Britain got into the situation it is in. But also the arguments that I put about the nature of the state institutions, the unelected organizations that run British society, does apply to other countries, certainly applies probably and some to the situation in the United States. So I think there, you know, there are important lessons to be learned. But I think in general, the left needs to be looking at our history, our collective history, a bit more seriously than we have done up to now, because, you know, what's fantastic, so many new people coming into left-wing politics, lots of young activists getting involved for the first time, which is obviously fantastically positive and very, very exciting. But at the same time, we need to be a left that understands the world, because if we don't understand the world at a theoretical and historical level, we won't be able to change it. And so, you know, I'm not necessarily saying read this book, but although I am, but I mean, just immerse yourself in the history of the movement. And I think the sort of, you know, the political theory as well is very, very important. And for me, when it comes to the state, the question, the Marxist theory of the state is very, very powerful, because it has an understanding of the role the state plays in propping up the status quo that I don't think you find elsewhere. So I think that's very, very important. But in terms of the positives, I mean, I've written this book really because it is such an exciting situation we're in. In Britain, we face for the first time in generations the possibility of a left-wing government, which is fantastically important. It's going to open up massive possibilities. But that itself is an expression of a radicalization that's going on in British society. I mean, 13 million people voted for Jeremy Corbyn in 2017, which is, you know, 13 million people voting for a politician who has been excoriated as being a Marxist, a leftist, radical, you know, an anti-imperialist. I mean, people knew what they were voting for when they voted for him, because you couldn't miss it because the demonization has been so strong. So you are talking about, for various reasons that I touch on in the book, a situation where there's a big, big left in Britain now. It's not very well organized. It may not be particularly well, you know, there's lots of disagreements and arguments within it, but nevertheless, it is something to behold and it's something to be excited about. And if we can, get, you know, develop a coherent strategy for change, and if we can link up the openings that are potentially being created in Parliament with a much broader mass movement on the ground, and a social mobilisation in the workplaces and the communities and the universities, then, you know, I think if we could do that, then really anything is possible.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Chris Nynam, author of The British State, A Warning, and also the excellent How the Establishment Lost Control, thank you for providing us with a parallax view.
No worries. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Chris Nynam, author of The British State, A Warning, which will be available from Zero Books on October 25th. What did you think of the conversation? Drop me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. If you're a Patreon supporter, you'll be able to view a video version of this episode in the near future, in addition to Parallax Views The Week That Was, the new Parallax Views current events program. To all my current Patreon supporters, I just want to say thank you. You're the ones that make this show possible. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.